So this is to be just a very quick set of notes on the Said reading from Orientalism. I basically just want to clarify the concept of Orientalism and say how that fits into our class, because it's something that I want everybody to have in mind as we go forward. In a way, I think this text could fit in the latter half of the semester, because in large measure it bears upon how our vision of the greater world is modulated for us, how we're convinced to look at geopolitics and what so-called our nation does in the geopolitical field. So that's something that we're especially concerned about in the second half of the class. But there's also a connection to Du Bois and to the question of how we identify ourselves, who we think we are. And this connects, I think, also with the ways in which we are dominated and the ways in which our identity is controlled. Okay, that said, we're looking at Edward Said and his most famous book, Orientalism. Said was a Palestinian intellectual who probably went through multiple universities, but at the end of his life, he was at Columbia University. A prestigious, very well-known intellectual, but as a Palestinian, somebody who had a direct and lived an ongoing experience of what it means to be colonized, what it means to be in an inferior position socially and economically and racially. So as this intellectual, as this academic, Said, the Palestinian, finds himself in contact with and surveying these very strange bodies of knowledge about people like him. He runs into this in the academy, and what he finds there, you know, this becomes the topic of this famous book, is a body of knowledge, a long-lived body of knowledge called Orientalism. Now, the starting point for this, I guess, is to recognize that the term Orient has a broader and different application in the European context than it generally does in the United States context, which is not to say that there is no Orientalist knowledge or that Orientalism is not carried out in the United States. It certainly is. But in that everyday usage of the Orient from a European perspective would be included not just the Far East, which is typically the United States usage, Japan, China, maybe Southeast Asia. But in the European usage, the Orient includes everything from Morocco, which is way north and way west in Africa, right? Like, you don't get any closer to Europe than that. There probably could even be the suggestion from this European point of view that the Orient acted upon Spain, and so that Spain has a certain Oriental character, meaning that it was occupied by and influenced by Muslims historically. So everything from Morocco all the way to, like, Japan. I mean, this is a massive portion of the earth. Maybe it's the biggest portion of the earth, and yet historically, European scholars, specifically British and French scholars operating in the period of British and French colonialism, talked about that entire range and the people who lived there as if they were somehow basically equivalent. If you know an Oriental, you know an Oriental. If you know how Moroccans behave, you know how Japanese people behave. If you know how Libyans behave, you know how Indians behave. They're all the same, those Orientals. They're all below the Europeans. That was the nature of Orientalism. And yet it produced this massive body of literature. Some of it imaginative, some of it is literary, but some of it is also kind of quasi-social science and bureaucratic and apparently factual. So Said runs into this big body of so-called knowledge called Orientalism, and he also runs into the current manifestations of that, which I think in our context would usually be referred to as area studies. These are the kinds of things that exist particularly in political science. And the people who carry out those studies tend to think that they are simply objective knowers, knowing this region of the world, you know, area studies, expert on Iran, expert on Korea, expert on China. They tend to think that there's nothing problematic about that, that they're just applying objective Western scientific methods to social and to political phenomena in the rest of the world. But Said is really clear that actually what they're doing is continuing the Orientalist doctrines, which stemmed from the British and French colonial period. And with the extension of those doctrines, they are continuing the basic colonial relationships between a dominating West and a dominated East. That's still happening today. And if you make it all the way to the end of the Zaid reading, you'll find that. You'll see those detailed things. I mean, I've run into students who had been trained as interrogators in the United States Army and had been given books that Said himself refers to, particularly a book by, I think his name is George Patai, called The Arab Mind. This was a book, you know, super Orientalist book, talking about how the Arab mind is different than the Western mind, and it's more backwards, and it's more cunning, and it's more lying, and so on. This book was used up until at least 10 years ago as training for Army interrogators, the very people who will come into direct contact with these populations and violent contact with these populations. They are caused to know Arab populations in a totally racist, domineering, and violent fashion. So Said sees this, right? And he's kind of freaked out. And that's why he writes the book. Okay, so there is a connection, as I said, to Du Bois. You know, Du Bois, we were talking about the imposition or the production of so-called double consciousness, where, you know, a couple of models are offered to dominated people, primarily, sometimes models that they can't quite live up to because they're just not white enough, really, or just not male enough, or just not rich enough, or whatever it is. There's a model of who you can't be, and then there's also a model of who you shouldn't be, but you probably are. These are racial stereotypes, which in large measure correspond to people of color who arguably are colonized or have been colonized in the United States, but then also apply probably more broadly to groups like the miners in Appalachia, who we read about, who most of you are probably trained up to believe are a bunch of inbred idiots. That's also the same process of racialization. So there's a good model that you're supposed to achieve, but you can't, and there's a bad model, which you're supposed to not be, but you can't help it. And this divides you internally. So what we're looking at is the distribution of models about who you are socially, which then have consequences, have effects on who you think you are and who you feel you are and how you live your life internally, psychologically. There is an overlap with Orientalism here, but now we're talking about a much broader field. We're not just talking about representations of who you are, although that is included here. The us is who you're supposed to be. You're supposed to identify with the Westerners, right? The ones who are more advanced, the ones who are more scientific. This is the colonial rhetoric that's going on here. So there's a function of identification, but now the identification is in opposition to some really unknown thing far off in the distance over there where they do things differently and are backwards and are more violent and are more tribal, etc. So we can be talking about Arabs, Iranians, and so on. Okay, so I don't know, technical concept number one, and I'll really just talk about two technical concepts. Technical concept number one here is Said is drawing from Michel Foucault, and he's talking about the relationship of knowledge and power. I think if you wanted to make a simple point here, and even if you wanted to think about it in the real context where Said was operating, it's as simple as recognizing that knowledge is not just some objective thing that exists in the academy or in some institute of science. This is, I think, the model of science, the, I would say, ideological model of science, which is appropriate both to Orientalism and to the academy itself and to scientists or the institutions of science itself. In all of these places, there's a rhetoric that knowledge is just objective. And in fact, part of the Orientalist model is to suggest that Westerners are the only ones who have objective knowledge, because they alone have come to recognize that the world is something measurable, distinct from them, and which can and should be approached with these methods which are supposed to be non-subjective and guarantee something like objectivity. So that is what people say. That's what academics say. That's what professors say. That's what a lot of scientists even themselves think and recognize. You know, scientists can be smart all day long in their field, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they've thought about what constitutes their field or how their field fits into a general situation of power. And nevertheless, the field does sit in some field of power. And so I suppose this is the starting point for understanding Said. Knowledge is never separate from power, never in reality separate from power. And especially the kind of knowledge that he's thinking about, this cultural knowledge, knowledge of religious practices, knowledge of population, knowledge of customs and habits, knowledge of modes of governance, all of those things which are masquerading as objective knowledge under the heading of Orientalism. So this is, you know, a big academic body of knowledge in the 18 and 1900s, and then passing into contemporary area studies in the social sciences. Those things in particular are not independent of power. In fact, they come about because of power relations between colonial Europe or colonizing Europe and the colonized Muslim world, the colonized Middle East, the colonized East, India, China. Because there was a colonial relationship between those two places, that's the context in which Orientalism as a knowledge could be generated. But then the actual kind of knowledge that was generated by means of that power imbalance, or as a result of that power imbalance, that knowledge itself served and still serves particular practical functions which augment and continue the larger scale relationships of power between the so-called West and the so-called East. So how does this work in particular? So there's an historical reality, a colonial reality between Europe and the Middle East, between Europe and India and China. Egypt and India are the two places that he focuses on in the chapters that I gave you. What did that colonial relationship allow to happen? Because Napoleon went into Egypt in, 1797, what was then possible? Well, the French have a controlling position over Egyptian territory. What happens is that a whole bunch of European intellectuals, and not only French ones, start to descend upon Egypt. And so we're talking about missionaries, we're talking about scholars, we're talking about bureaucrats, we're talking about soldiers. These waves of interested parties show up. And I mean, think about, you know, the missionary or the soldier are clearly there in order to continue the imposition of power for the European colonizer, right? But they don't necessarily say that. And definitely the missionary and the scholar don't say that's why they're there. They think that they're there, the missionary thinks they're there in order to improve Egypt, to improve Egyptians. Like, it's, you know, the missionary has in her heart only a pure gift of, you know, the superior religious whatever understandings that she has, and she's going to give it to these who? These others, right? Because Europe is in a position of power with respect to Egypt, it can send its emissaries and its gatherers of knowledge into Egypt. And then these scholars, missionaries, soldiers, bureaucrats, they begin to generate a body of knowledge. And that body of knowledge, on the one hand, it's totally, there's some of it that, like, you could say is totally fictitious, right? We're talking about poetry, and we're talking about kind of the romance of the Orient as it shows up in French literature in the 19th century. I mean, that's not pretending to be true, but it is producing an imaginary knowledge about what the Orient is. It's producing stereotypes in the minds of European people who go to the Orient. It's even producing a circumstance eventually where so-called Oriental people, Egyptian people, are going to be subjected to the image of themselves that was generated by their oppressor. So it's going to put them into a situation of double consciousness where what they are told about themselves doesn't match up with what they know and need to feel about themselves. Okay, so it's because there is a situation of power that the knowledge can be generated. But once the knowledge is generated, and it's not just fictitious or stereotypical notions that show up like in poetry, it's also much more detailed studies, so-called or apparently objective studies of religious practices, of governmental practices, of populations. And the knowledge that is generated in that way, while it might constitute kind of a dangerous misrepresentation of Egyptian people or Indian people, nevertheless, the so-called knowledge is detailed enough to recommend policy, to recommend ways of dealing with those people, ways of dealing with their religion, ways of breaking down or building up religious practice or not, breaking down or building up certain cultural practices, breaking down or building up certain nodes of government, all for the purpose of reinforcing and augmenting and spreading European colonial control over those territories. So knowledge and power are related. This is the sort of thing that we'll probably come back to a number of times in this semester. However, it is the second most important key concept out of this reading. Now, here's the most important one. The most important concept is simply what Zaid calls Orientalism, or what he'll call the essence of Orientalism, which is really very simple. The essence of Orientalism is us versus them, where us is the so-called West, and them is the so-called East. But it doesn't even have to be the so-called East, because we don't really talk that much about the East right now, but we do still talk about the West, right? And we do still talk about the Muslim world as if it were somehow backwards and not as objective and not as advanced as the so-called West, right? So this notion that there is a fundamental difference between Europe, which first of all is Britain and France, these primary colonizers come the 1800s and late 1800s, and then the United States, which especially in the aftermath of World War II picks up British and French colonial interests all over the globe. Now the Westerners are the U.S. The basic idea, this is a racist model, and it's a racist way of causing you to understand who you are, and it's a racist way of causing you to believe that where you are is superior to everything else. And it's a racist and misleading way of causing you to affirm whatever so-called your government is doing in the rest of the world, which, on the other hand, we're generally kept ignorant about. Right? Well, it's them over there. You know, it's not the Westerners. It's not the people who are objective. It's not the ones who are real scientists. It's not the ones who have real democracy, the ones who really know what is good government. It's not us. We know that stuff. It's them. They don't know any of that stuff. Right? So we have a basic racist divide, a basic us-them divide, which, you know, if you read somebody like Cedric Robinson, for example, it seems like this us-them kind of distinction between Europe and the rest of the world was already being generated in the period of the Crusades, in the period where Europe gets really isolated and enclosed within its Christian dogma, its Christian worldview, while the Arab world is still bustling and cosmopolitan and scientific. Europe regresses back to a basically biblical understanding, losing a whole lot of the knowledges that they had in the past. And this us-them thing comes from that period, which is funny because now the us-them thing is all about how we are much more objective and understanding and logical than them, even though the them in this case includes the Arabs, who invented much of the math that the Europeans only picked up later. Okay, so what's the basic division? You have on the one side good guys, the United States, Britain, France, the so-called West. What are the alleged characteristics of the people over here? They're rational, clear-headed, skeptical. They demand reasons for things, basically noble. And then on the other hand, you have all the opposites. And who's on the other hand? Well, in this case, Egypt, India, Palestine. In our present context, I would definitely say North Korea, China, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Palestine, Iran. But then also this sort of logic which is a basically colonial logic, right? There's us and we're the good ones and we give good government, but those other ones, they're so backwards that they can't possibly give themselves good government and they don't even know what's good for them. Luckily for them, they have us who are so knowing and we give good government. So in dominating them, we're actually helping them out because they're so inferior. We still have this sort of logic and we also have it internally. Right. So this is the same kind of colonial logic that has been used in talking about the black population in the United States or the Mexican-American population or even hillbillies or even historically women, too. And women are supposed to be less rational, less clear, less skeptical, less noble. You know, so what are the characteristics of these others or these Orientals or whatever? They're illogical. They're liars. They're kind of sneaky, crazy, a little lazy, but gullible, childlike, kind of just off, different, depraved. And by the time you get to the contemporary treatments of the Muslim world, then even like very educated people are saying completely uneducated things like, okay, Islam is an anti-human religion. That whole area is basically anti-human. And so in dominating it, the U.S. or Europe or whatever is actually humanizing it. Even if we're preventing self-determination, even if we're preventing nationalization, we're doing it for their own good. You know, even if like the moment we show up in Iraq, there's a massive insurgency because Iraqis don't actually want us there. Recently, what was it? Even though the Iraqis asked the U.S. to leave and the U.S. is technically only there because it's a guest of Iraq, which supposedly is asking so-called us to be there, even though they ask us to leave, we're not leaving because they don't actually know what's good for them, right? And when they say things like that, they don't really know what they're doing. We know, they don't know. Okay, this fundamental divide, we can deal with it in two ways. One is important for us right now, and I would ask you, like, the key question this week would be like, okay, so who's us? Do you identify with this us? And do you find yourself potentially guilty of repeating this basically colonial logic that our society, our Western so-called democratic society, is scientific and objective, but their so-called society, especially the Muslims, the Muslim world, isn't it backwards? Or like North Korea, it's completely backwards. Everybody there's stupid. And you know, it's we don't go this far. We don't say this part of the racist thing anymore. But I think we imply it. You know, these Orientals, they're prone to despotism, right? Like they're prone to forms of dictatorship. In order to get them out of that, like South Korea say, they would need guidance from the more enlightened West, right? Which is code language for they would need to allow the West to organize their territory, their resources, their labor, their affairs for the benefit of the West. But the West will say, oh, no, it's actually in everybody's benefit because we have these wonderful, rational systems of government and extraction and exchange and economy, which everybody can benefit. And the only reason they don't have them is because they're backwards. Okay, anyway, so I think the key question is to ask, do we identify in this way? And do we have a part of our identity, which is a part of ideology, really, is a part of our identity built out of a comparison between ourselves as allegedly good and these others, the terrorist, the Arab, the Muslim radical, and maybe sometimes the anarchists, the extremists, these like kind of fictitious others? Do we actually get a big portion of our sense of who we are out of this contrast? That's the key thing for today. And then for the second half of the semester, just start paying attention to the ways in which all these other places are represented, especially in the media. Think about this. Like this is an ideological mechanism which allows for the utter simplification and utter falsification of untold numbers of news items and military endeavors and economic power relationships all over the world. Well, there's us and then there's them. There's the West and then there's the not West. And as a result of our belief that the not West is a bunch of lying babies who are not so human as we are, although we don't want to quite say that, but that's implied in this, dominating them, bombing them, invading them, controlling their territory, extorting them, forcing them to make changes to their society via the IMF and the World Bank. All these things are justified, aren't they? Because we believe that they are less than us.